Dr. Banner. Now might be a really good time for you to get angry.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry.
By 1814, British armies composed largely of veterans from European campaigns were sent to America. The United States was to be invaded from the north and from the south. And as a diversion, cities on the seaboard were to be raided and laid waste. The capital city of Washington was selected. At Bladensburg on the District of Columbia line, the British marauders were met by several thousand raw and demoralized militia. The one stout stand was by Commodore Barney's handful of sailors and marines. The British entered Washington, burned the Navy Yard, the Capitol, the White House.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes, we hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Welcome back to the Angry History Show.
This week, we're going to visit one of the most humiliating days in American history, August 24th, 1814.
Sorry, you could narrow it down. Go ahead. But anyway, sorry that got me. I'm laughing because that's my wedding anniversary is August 24th. And we're thinking, did we really embarrass the country that much? But so go ahead.
On August 24th, 1814, British forces under Major General Robert Ross and Rear Admiral George Cockburn, nicknamed the Ruffian by an anti-British Washington newspaper that we'll hear about a little later, landed on the shore of Chesapeake Bay, routed the defenders, and marched on the still unfinished Capitol.
Then, as their crowning achievement, they torched what we now know as the White House, called things like the President's House or Executive Mansion until TR officially changed the name in 1901. And here's a quick clip of President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron citing the event at a joint press conference on November 4th, 2013. Give a listen.
It's now been 200 years since the British came here to the White House under somewhat different circumstances. They made quite an impression. They really lit up the place. But we moved on.
So I am a little embarrassed as I stand here to think that 200 years ago, my ancestors tried to burn this place down. Now, looking around me, I can see you've got the place a little better defended today. You're clearly not taking any risks with the Brits this time.
In case you're wondering, we didn't add a laugh track there. No. When I was listening to that clip, it sounds like it's MASH or something. Well, thanks. I didn't know Alan Alda was funny. It's good that you helped me to know I was supposed to be laughing. That's just how people react at diplomatic functions.
Wasn't a chicken. It was a baby!
That's just how those cookie pushers react, which is cookie pusher. They used a lot in, I guess, the Victorian era to describe diplomats at Foggy Bottom. And that sounds delicious. I want to bring that back.
But
that's just how they laugh. And leaders are allowed to joke about the fire, it seems. Tony Blair made a similar quip when accepting his congressional gold medal in 2003.
On our way down here, Senator Frist was kind enough to show me the fireplace where in 1814 the British had burnt the Congress Library. I know this is kind of late, but sorry.
Yeah, it's kind of funny now, you know. I guess you can make jokes. I mean, I'm not sure why you think it's – I don't know. Are we being overly sensitive? Is it okay to make jokes about this now because we're buddies and our special relationship? But I don't know. The British Embassy tried to get in on the laughs and found itself in hot water. So on the bicentennial of stacking Madison and Jefferson's furniture and sprinkling it with gunpowder, they tweeted out a picture of a White House-shaped cake adorned with sparklers. Isn't that adorable?
Yeah, I guess somebody thought this was a great idea. And keep in mind, there's as far as specifically burning down the White House, there wasn't a loss of life. And I don't think anybody was caught up in the fire, although there might have been if Dolly Madison had made a different call, which, again, that's more foreshadowing, more teasing.
Sure.
But the tweet read, commemorating the 200th anniversary of the burning of the White House, only sparklers this time.
What do they do for Dresden? What do they have, like a bundt cake with sparklers on it?
A bundt. Yeah. Well, but people died at Dresden, I could see. But
right.
There was this outpouring of anger on Twitter, of all places.
Wait. Twitter got out of time legs? Really?
Yeah, a bunch of people were upset, and the embassy had to come out and apologize. And they said, quote, "We meant to mark an event in history and celebrate our strong friendship today."
Okay, sure. Why not?
Well, that was our idea. We talked about burning your... And we all have friends like that. Hey, remember that time I lit your car on fire because I was mad at you? Like, okay, hey, the prime ministers and presidents are joking about
that's
it.
Right.
You figure, hey, but no, and not so on Twitter.
Exactly. And your neighbors, the Alexandrias, well, their car didn't get burned. I wonder why.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's talk a bit about how this war got started. So both the UK and France had committed insults against U.S. interests as they fought the Napoleonic Wars, okay? But it was the impressment of American seamen into the British Navy that ultimately spurred the young nation to take up arms. You want to force guys to serve. I mean, this is what we're talking about here. That's what impressment is. You would have to fight for the other guy. You really would have no choice in the matter. And if you think it was insane to declare war on one of the world's superpowers, you'll love what T.R. wrote in his landmark book, The Naval War of 1812.
Yeah, the future president stated that the U.S. undoubtedly ought to have declared war on both the Empire and France.
you were about to head into a TR impression, weren't you?
I don't know. I was just feeling it there. How else can you say something so grandiose it doesn't come out in TR's voice? But I remember when I read that the first time, I couldn't believe that that was his idea. And then I thought about it for a split second. I said, well, what am I saying? I can completely believe that. That sounds like exactly what TR was.
Exactly. It's true. And like Brooklyn's own Steve Rogers before the super soldier serum, the famed War Hawk Congress wouldn't back down from a bully, even if they didn't have the muscle to really go toe-to-toe with either of those countries. And TR stated, quote, "As it was, we choose as a foe that one that had done and could still do us the greatest injury." All right, that was, I don't know, that's TR.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. That was a TR.
You know, TR always reminds me of the, what is that, the Americans' ability to lead, to lead themselves, to govern themselves, to whatever. There was a great soundbite of his, but
yeah,
anyway.
That's right.
The great fundamental issue now before our people can be stated briefly. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not.
We played that in the Presidential Voices episode.
Yep. And Dean plays it to go to sleep every night.
I do have the McKinley come up every now and then.
Right. That's true. That's a scary soundbite, though. The audio quality was so bizarre on that one, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, with the sort of the ghostly sound there in the background. Those are all wax cylinders, right?
Yeah.
So
yep.
Things are always a little bit strange. But setting the White House ablaze back to 1814, it gave rise to some myths. The first was that the building was painted white to conceal fire damage. The White House Historical Association explains, quote, "It had nothing to do with the burning of the house by the British in 1814, although every schoolchild is likely to have heard the story that way. The building was first made white with lime-based whitewash in 1798, when the walls were finished, simply as a means of protecting the porous stone from freezing," unquote.
Why they kept painting the house white, nobody really knows, but maybe it just looked better, you know, it's sort of clean lines. You can still see fire-blackened stones if you visit the White House today or if you, you know, fly your drone over the wall. They're atop an old entrance beneath the North Portico, and it's a stark reminder that in 1814, the flames were real, you know, in that steamy, malarial swamp of D.C.
Yeah, and let's set the stage today with a man who was there. 15-year-old Paul Jennings, James Madison's slave valet and the man at his side when he died in 1836. This is our pal, novelist Don Winston, performing the reading. Jennings describes the war jitters as a conflict confined to the Atlantic and the Great Lakes for 2 years reaches his doorstep.
A colored man's reminiscences of James Madison. Paul Jennings, born 1799. After the war had been going on for a couple of years, the people of Washington began to be alarmed for the safety of the city, as the British held Chesapeake Bay with a powerful fleet and army. Everything seemed to be left to General Armstrong, then Secretary of War, who ridiculed the idea that there was any danger. But in August 1814, the enemy had got so near, there could be no doubt of their intentions. Great alarm existed, and some feeble preparations for defense were made.
Feeble preparations indeed. It had to have been a terrifying time. Jennings was the first person to write a memoir of his time in the White House, and when Mrs. Madison failed to free him upon her husband's death, way to go, Dolly, Jennings set out to purchase his freedom, with Daniel Webster's help, actually, and to buy emancipation for his wife and for his kids.
Jennings called James Madison one of the finest men he ever knew. So while many slaves looked at the British as liberators, although they had not yet banned slavery themselves, Jennings didn't see the war as a chance to flee. When the enemy reached Bladensburg, just 6 miles northeast of the capital, he remained steadfastly at Mrs. Madison's side.
Well, on the 24th of August, sure enough, the British reached Bladensburg, and the fight began between 11 and 12. Even that very morning, General Armstrong assured Mrs. Madison there was no danger. The president, with General Armstrong, General Winder, and Colonel Monroe, rode out on horseback to Bladensburg to see how things looked. Mrs. Madison ordered dinner to be ready at 3 as usual. I set the table myself and brought up the ale, cider, and wine and placed them in the coolers, as all the cabinet and several military gentlemen and strangers were expected.
Okay, you heard Jennings list a few people here. Chief among them were a politically connected lawyer turned Brigadier General William Winder, charged with the city's defense, and General John Armstrong Jr., the hapless Secretary of War. This casual attitude was certainly enough to make any American angry.
I know I would have been angry. I'm angry just reading about it in history books. People are counting on you. It doesn't matter what side you are or where you're
right.
from, but we're counting on you here. We're giving you a big position. You got ratified by the Senate barely, but still, you're entrusted with something and you're saying, no. What are you worried about that for?
Right.
As the Redcoats marched south the day before the burning, President Madison called an emergency war council. Armstrong didn't even bother to show up on time. This is how much the guy cared.
Yeah.
When he finally waltzed in, as my mother would say, he ridiculed the idea of defending Washington City, pointing out that it had just 8,000 citizens. Huh, heck with them, I guess.
Yeah.
And a few government buildings littering in the swamp.
But there's an attitude toward citizens in D.C. Even today. It's like, you voted for something? Well, let us be the final arbiter of that. But you just keep on. Armstrong said, quote, "They certainly will not come here. What the devil will they do here? No, Baltimore is the place, sir. That is of so much more consequence." End quote. He seems to not have considered the fact that the British could actually, strike both places. It's kind of like a boxer covering his face but leaving his stomach wide open, for a classic haymaker. Historian Henry Adams, grandson of John Quincy, described Armstrong's reputation at the time. Again, Don Winston.
In spite of Armstrong's services, abilities, and experience, something in his character always created distrust. He had every advantage of education, social and political connection, ability, and self-confidence. He was only 54 years old, which was also the age of Monroe. But he suffered from the reputation of indolence and intrigue. So strong was the prejudice against him that he obtained only 18 votes against 15 in the Senate on his confirmation. And while the two senators from Virginia did not vote at all, the two from Kentucky voted in the negative. Under such circumstances, nothing but military success of the first order could secure a fair field for Monroe's rival, Henry Adams.
But Armstrong didn't have anything like military success, quite the opposite, actually. So 4,500 hardened British veterans wheeled south and routed the 5,500 tradesmen and farmers of the American militia. This failure ended any chance Armstrong had of eclipsing Monroe's heroic service under General Washington in the Revolution. And it did a lot to cement his memory of someone Dean is really not fond of.
He's lucky he had a cool name like Armstrong.
Yeah, Armstrong.
If he'd had some name like a Benedict Arnold or a Major Andre or a Quisling, or McClellan, we still think of McClellan that way. It's not like he was the first general not to want to move off his butt.
Exactly.
So he's lucky he had that cool name. And I don't know if he was related to the first man on the moon, but somehow I can't imagine it.
Stretch Armstrong. He was married to Stretch Armstrong. He was certainly related to him. General Milksop doesn't sound nearly as powerful. It's probably more just like,
why go to the moon? Mars is the place.
Yes, Mars is the place.
Perhaps Vulcan.
Yeah, exactly. They're not going to attack Earth and Mars.
Keep in mind that at the time, the United States rejected the idea of a standing army. The several states relied on that well-regulated militia being necessary for the national defense, as mentioned in the Second Amendment. Some of these militia didn't even have the right clothes or shoes.
No, and then say nothing about, stylish jeans of the day. But in 2014, author Alan Taylor told the Washington Post how these militiamen prepared themselves. Quote, "They have one training day a year, which is mostly spent drinking rather than drilling. This is how we prepare for the Angry History Show. Whoever was elected captain would take them down to the local tavern and they'd get blasted," unquote.
It sounds really funny until you're counting on those guys to keep your capital city from getting burned, right?
They're
like Swiss watch. The Constitution is a miracle. There's a miracle in Philadelphia, but a little failure in execution.
Yeah, it's
Although maybe as long as Washington was alive, they figured, well, that was enough. He could take care of any problem. But the generals gone by this point, so you're on your own, kids.
Right. You've got General Armstrong. You go home and get your shine box, okay, General Armstrong.
The lack of discipline of a regular army was reflected in the burning, vandalizing, and plundering of York, the present-day Toronto, which Americans pronounce Toronto.
Right.
And speaking before of your marriage, I'm, of course, married to a former Canadian. As I like to say, I used to be married to a Canadian. She's an American citizen now.
That's right.
And when we first met, she would often tell me I was pronouncing Toronto wrong, like an American. Americans pronounce it wrong. And I said, there's more of us than you. So right. Therefore, how we pronounce it is right. But I've come around since, for the sake of marital bliss. Toronto, or York, was then the capital of Upper Canada, today's Ontario. The American soldiers stole one item of particular significance, the parliamentary mace, a gilded staff adorned with a brass crown. And to show the Americans could hold a grudge too, the U.S. didn't return the mace to the Great White North until 1934, 120 years later.
It did because it pleased us to. That the British might seek revenge for the sacking of York didn't really seem to occur to Armstrong. And by the time the British reached the... I'm sorry, I just keep thinking of this guy as Stretch Armstrong. And remember what happened when you put Stretch Armstrong in the freezer and then took a hammer to him? That's what should happen to you, General Armstrong. By the time the British reached the outskirts of D.C., it was entirely too late. The War Council dissolved. Generals fled. When President Madison decided he should go too, someone handed him a pair of pistols, and the president strapped them to his waist and was ready for action. I just love this visual. You know, it's like, can you imagine? Yeah. It's like, President Obama, someone's coming to the White House. Here, take all these guns. Let's go. Get behind that desk. Let's do this. You know? But I could picture Madison doing it.
Yeah, well, I remember Reagan at one point when he was president, he opened up his briefcase, I believe aboard Air Force One, and he had a gun in there. And everyone, you know, all the Secret Service guys, weapon, secure the gun. And he said, no, I saw what happened to Dr. King and the Kennedys, and it's not going to happen to me.
Oh, man. Okay. And when was later, this before he was, before the attempt on his life, or was this after?
I don't know exactly when it was. I remember reading about it then, and then there's a great book called Riding with Reagan by the Secret Service man who was assigned to him. They needed a man who could ride a horse and keep up with the right. president at the ranch where you and I have been together. You know, mm-hmm. that's a big expanse, people riding. And guys were getting hurt because they couldn't keep up.
No, try the pulled pork sandwich, by the way. Delicious.
Oh, yeah, that was
good. It really was.
Yeah, it was. It was very good.
That was a fun day, actually.
Yeah, a lot of presidential museums. That was one that had a really good restaurant.
Well, it was gorgeous, too, the whole surrounding area, that part. Yeah. Anyway.
But that's a great book, and there's another thing there where he, at one point, he's on his horse when he's president, and there's mm-hmm. it's the height of the Cold War, and he had a fish pond, the president did, and there was, I believe it was a hawk, and it was stealing the fish, and he said, I'm going to get it. So one day, he got on the horse, he's wearing one of those presidential windbreakers that you see, and the Secret Service guy doesn't think anything of it, and they're driving by, and they see the hawk come down, and it goes, and it grabs one of the koi fish in there, and the president whips out the gun, shoots at the hawk, you know, knocks it down. And of course, you know, there's sensors, there's Secret Service agents all around, right. everything. And the agent, who I think it's Barletta is his name, he radios back and he tells them in sort of this crazed situation where everyone's thinking something happened, the president's been shot. He said, rawhide shot. And he meant Rawhide, being the president's
did the shooting.
Service nickname, did the shooting. But they thought, oh, my God. So it was crazy. And so he went back with them, and he does kind of a little miming of it where he demonstrates the president. He went there and said, sir, we can't have firearms. I have to secure all of them. And
right.
he gives him, you know, gives him the gun he shot the bear with. All of them, sir. Gives him, like, another one.
Yeah.
Like, it's sir, like, all of them. He's like, Reagan lifts up the couch cushion, and there's, like, a .38 under there.
Well, no, isn't it? It's like when they're spanking Finster Baby and all those. Those weapons are falling out of them. It's like, you know, guns and knives. And it's like, and Mr. President, please, going forward, if you want to shoot something, just hit him over the head with Casper Weinberger instead. Thank you.
So the fourth president, not all that tall, not a warrior statesman, not even as tall as Reagan, certainly not the giant George Washington.
Yeah, 800 feet in height.
Yeah,
but,
right.
I don't make up the history. We just report it.
This was the diminutive North Paul James Madison, a man with no military training and weighing in at a paltry 100 pounds soaking wet, 5 feet 4 inches tall, clearly overmatched in any pugilistic endeavor.
And he has no choice but to hit below the belt. He just can't help himself.
Well, the gun might have helped.
Sweet.
Exactly. And here he is, you know, strapped like Frank Castle, the Marvel's The Punisher, in the August heat. He's ready to go down fighting. And it's such a majestic image. And then you read, oh, yeah, at one point he almost rode into the British lines and got himself captured. So
oops.
They leave the fight. I guess you can't say leave the fighting to the generals because they're not very good. So.
No, especially General Armstrong sitting there reading a copy of Field and Stream.
Yeah. Dazzler.
Dazzler. Yeah, you're reading Dazzler number one. Wait a second. This is in near mint condition. I can get $20 for this. General, what?
Maybe defending with the capital, sir. Ah, come on, they're not coming, I keep telling you.
Exactly. What kind of mutant power is it to have light and sound? Anyway, there's a war going on.
Yes, there is a war.
It's covered. They're attacking Baltimore, okay? Don't worry about it. As the U.S. defenses collapsed, Secretary of State James Monroe took control, rearranging the second line of defense. So based on what Henry Adams said, that really had to bug Armstrong if he, you know, cared enough. A hero badly wounded in the Battle of Trenton and often called, like, the little brother of the American Revolution, Monroe would succeed Madison and be the next president to live in the restored White House.
But before the fire, Mrs. Madison described the scene at the mansion in a letter to one of her sisters, likely Anna Cutts, wife of Richard Cutts, who sent Paul Jennings racing to fetch his carriage ahead of the British advance. Here's Dolly's description, which she's believed to have added to decades later for some color. It's performed for Angry History by another writer friend of ours, Amanda Reed, who gave voice to the letters in our Alexandria, Virginia episode.
Tuesday, August 23rd, 1814. Dear sister, my husband left me yesterday morning to join General Winder. He inquired anxiously whether I had the courage or firmness to remain in the President's house until his return, on the morrow or succeeding day, and on my assurance that I had no fear but for him and the success of our army, he left me, beseeching me to take care of myself and of the cabinet papers, public and private. I have since received two dispatches from him, written with a pencil. The last is alarming, because he desires I should be ready at a moment's warning to enter my carriage and leave the city, that the enemy seemed stronger than had been reported, and that it might happen that they would reach the city with intention to destroy it. I am accordingly ready. I have pressed as many cabinet papers into trunks as to fill one carriage. Our private property must be sacrificed, as it is impossible to procure wagons for its transportation. I am determined not to go myself until I see Mr. Madison safe, and he can accompany me. As I hear of much hostility towards him, disaffection stalks around us. My friends and acquaintances are all gone, even Colonel C. with his 100 men who were stationed as guard in the enclosure.
Next, Dolly describes one staff member's idea to spring a trap on the British, and this is really kind of hilarious and a very human sort of thing. But a reminder, this was a war, and that the Americans had just fought a guerrilla action against the British not so long ago.
French John, a faithful domestic, with his usual activity and resolution, offers to spike the cannon at the gate, and to lay a train of powder which would blow up the British should they enter the house. To the last proposition I positively object, without being able, however, to make him understand why all advantages in war may not be taken.
Today we'd call that an IED, an improvised explosive device. That's such a great moment that the guy wanted to rig the White House to blow up. Again, I'm thinking of Bugs Bunny, maybe yeah. The A-Team, Wile E. Coyote. It's probably best, though, that Dolly nixed the idea, because the British might have retaliated and increased the bloodshed on all sides. One thing is, as we said, the burning of the White House, terrible thing, national symbol, so much is lost. But they weren't burning people alive, and they were trying to at least kind of just target the government, as Cockburn said. We have no problem with the people.
Right, right. Well, at least French John showed some fight, you know, which is more than we can say for the American militia in this case. At high noon, Dolly felt a sense of foreboding, separated from her husband, the highest value target of the invaders.
Wednesday morning, 12 o'clock. Since sunrise, I have been turning my spyglass in every direction and watching with unwearied anxiety, hoping to discern the approach of my dear husband and his friends. But, alas, I can descry only groups of military wandering in all directions, as if there was a lack of arms or of spirit to fight for their own firesides.
Yeah, it's like, come on, guys, let's pick up the fight, shall we, a little bit. The war arrived with the sound of cannons. Americans at Bladensburg, black and white, had bought time for the president to escape and to save the Constitution and Declaration of Independence to be destroyed much later by other Americans. But the British advance rolled on.
3 o'clock. Will you believe it, my sister? We have had a battle or skirmish near Bladensburg, and I am still here within sound of the cannon. Mr. Madison comes not. May God protect him. Two messengers covered with dust come to bid me fly. But I wait for him. At this late hour, a wagon has been procured. I have it filled with the plate and most valuable portable articles belonging to the house. Whether it will reach its destination, the Bank of Maryland, or fall into the hands of British soldiery, events must determine.
Time had almost run out for the people in the White House, But there was one national treasure Dolly couldn't let fall into enemy hands, knowing that even things she sent ahead might be captured and destroyed or used by the British. She personally safeguarded the portrait of General Washington.
Our kind friend Mr. Carroll has come to hasten my departure and is in a very bad humor with me, because I insist on waiting until the large picture of General Washington is secured, and it requires to be unscrewed from the wall. This process was found too tedious for these perilous moments. I have ordered the frame to be broken and the canvas taken out. It is done, and the precious portrait placed in the hands of two gentlemen of New York for safekeeping. And now, dear sister, I must leave this house, where the retreating army will make me a prisoner in it by filling up the road I am directed to take. When I shall again write you, or where I shall be tomorrow, I cannot tell. Dolly Madison.
I like how Mr. Carroll shows up. Come on, I gotta get you out of here. It risks his life to get there and save her. And she says, no, I gotta take the painting with me first. Are you kidding? You know what this costs? It's gotta come.
And all that silver.
Yeah.
Years from now, what is the Angry History Show gonna use as a logo?
That's true.
Yeah.
Today, not only is that Gilbert Stuart portrait our logo, which you may be looking at right now on your smartphone or other device, but it's the White House's most prized possession. It hangs in the East Room that you hear about a lot for diplomatic functions. But if you look at the books on Washington's table in that portrait, should you be fortunate enough to be in the White House and get really close to the painting, before they wrestle you to the ground.
Yeah, or take your drone away from you.
Look closely at the books on the table to the left of General Washington. One of them is titled Constitution and Laws of the United States. Yes, that's not one of my typically bad readings. It's actually what it's says, S-A-T-E-S. It's a copy. It's not the real thing.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's actually it was bought at a Holiday Inn artist sale by Newark Airport, I think. Dolly didn't know that, or she might not have risked her life for it, but she might have.
She probably would have saved James's Velvet Elvis instead.
Yes. Yeah,
so that was lost, and it really... That's
or the crushed Velvet Sacred Heart of Jesus clock, which was which is really nice. Anyway, Gilbert painted the mistake onto the many copies he sold instead of the part from the original, which you could admire today in the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, not far from their wonderful exhibit on Captain America and his Howling Commandos.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly where it is. And I've seen that. It's still moving.
It's extremely moving.
Portrait. It's great to see.
Yeah, especially seeing, you know, Dum Dum Duggan up there, and you know, all I can hear is just wahoo, and seeing Nazis fall. It's a beautiful day to take your children there. But
go ahead. Regardless of whether the portrait was real or not, Dolly didn't want Washington's likeness to fall into the hands of the British, who would surely have desecrated it. And no sooner did the White House staff secure the general than pandemonium broke loose. Here's Paul Jennings.
While waiting at just about 3, as Suki, the house servant, was lolling out of a chamber window, James Smith, a free colored man who had accompanied Mr. Madison to Bladensburg, galloped up to the house, waving his hat, and cried out, "Clear out! Clear out! General Armstrong has ordered a retreat." All then was confusion. Mrs. Madison ordered her carriage, and passing through the dining room, caught up what silver she could crowd into her old-fashioned reticule, and then jumped into the chariot with her servant girl Suki and Daniel Carroll, who took charge of them. Bolin drove them over to Georgetown Heights. The British were expected in a few minutes.
Time to get out of Dodge here for sure. Well, at least Armstrong was good for something. Ordering retreat. I'm picturing the hapless Captain Wilton Parameter from F Troop, played by the great Ken Berry, who accidentally sneezes in order to charge at Appomattox. But not all of the Americans bungled that day. Commodore Joshua Barney brought ashore his force of 360 sailors and 120 Marines, who fought hand to hand with cutlasses and pikes.
Commander Barney's flotilla was stripped of men who were placed in battery at Bladensburg, where they fought splendidly. A large part of his men were tall, strapping Negroes, mixed with white sailors and Marines. Mr. Madison reviewed them just before the fight and asked Commander Barney if his Negroes would not run on the approach of the British. "No, sir," said Barney. "They don't know how to run. They will die by their guns first." They fought till a large part of them were killed or wounded, and Barty himself wounded and taken prisoner.
At one point in the fight, again, the diminutive President Madison personally directed those Marines in the fight. Even the British were impressed by their gallantry, and they wounded Barney, and they took him captive, but they immediately paroled him because they felt that what he had done was very valorous, and this is the kind of thing that happened in warfare in those days. You had respect for your enemy, and it meant something to be an officer if you were captured.
Right, right. Such acts of honor might have given heart to the civilians in the army's path, but they really knew nothing of them and could only fear the worst. Here's Mary S. Hunter. She's alone at home in the capital. Her husband's gone, spiriting their children and most of their servants to safety.
Washington City, August 30th, 1814. About the middle of the day, we heard a severe cannonading in the direction of Bladensburg, and some hours after we saw our men running in great numbers in a disorderly manner. And in the evening, perhaps at sunsetting, I will leave you to conjecture what our feelings must have been when we saw the British flag flying on Capitol Hill, and the rockets brandished for the destruction of our capital, and for what other property we knew not.
Mrs. Hunter asks us to imagine her feelings upon seeing the Union Jack flying on Capitol Hill. I can't help but think of the Revolutionary War veterans that were on hand and how they must have reacted. Here's the old symbol of tyranny that their friends had given their lives for, that some of them had given limbs for, that they'd sat through that winter at Valley Forge and had suffered so much outside Boston and all these other places. And now here they're back and they're seeing the younger generation cut and run. Some of them, they say, didn't stop running till they got home. So that must have just been such a frustrating feeling.
Terribly disheartening. Yeah.
You mentioned before, you know, in a semi-joking manner about the Constitution today and us looking back at it. Imagine you gave so much to birth this new nation and now you're seeing the old enemy back. It must have been terrible. And this is why people refer to it in later years as the Second War for American Independence, because this was to sort of cement that idea that as bungling as we might be in this war, we could survive something like a terrible Secretary of War and an invasion. And it's a good thing for us that the British had their hands full with the French at the time and their fleet there and their army there. Or it would have been real trouble.
Yeah, no, our whole history could have been a, you know, Harry Turtledove story, you know. But,
yeah.
But anyway, Mary Hunter kept her head despite being alone at home without any of her nation's soldiers or her husband. And when she saw an enemy soldier approaching, she understandably feared the worst.
The glum-looking officer rode up to our door and asked me where my husband was. I informed him that he was not at home. He asked me when he went abroad. I told him this morning. What induced him, he said, to go abroad just at this time? I then looked him fully in the face and very deliberately told him that my husband was gone to take a family of young children from witnessing such a horrid scene. He asked when my husband was expected home. I told him that I had expected him this evening, but that under existing circumstances I hardly thought he would be home. This put a stop to all further interrogatories. I then asked him to go to the sideboard and help himself to any refreshments that were agreeable to him. And while he was regaling himself, I asked in my turn what they were going to do, whether to burn the city generally or confine themselves to the public buildings. He said that would depend on circumstances. Where no resistance was made, private property would be safe, especially to those who had remained in their houses. But that every house where resistance was made, or in which arms should be found, would be fired. After graciously assuring us that we need be under no apprehensions, that their troops were under the strictest discipline, that none dared to come into our houses without permission, he then told us that General Ross's horse had been shot under him from Gallatin's house and that it was burnt.
Now, one breach of protocol here, firing upon the British flag of truce, absolutely scuttled any chance that Washington City could have escaped the torch by surrendering like their neighbors Alexandria did across the Potomac into the south. But remember, Ross and Cockburn had only a small force, okay, too small to occupy the city or to crush a rebellion.
Right, so it paid them to maintain good relations with the locals. Again, to use a modern term, we'd say winning hearts and minds. And it paid for the ladies of Washington, for their part, home alone, many of them, like Mary Hunter, to be polite as well and try to reach some accommodation. They spent a lot of time making arguments like, don't burn the patent office. Patents are private property. You said you wouldn't burn private property, so come on. And that was it. So that was basically how this war was going. In a way, the diplomacy came after the invasion, which is kind of new.
I went across the street to a neighbor's house from whence I could have a better view of the Capitol. At this house, a number of the officers were taking some refreshment, and seeing us alarmed, they said everything that could be said to quiet us. I told them I had seen many British officers who were gentlemen, and that I could not bring myself to be afraid. I mentioned that a quantity of powder had been deposited in the Capitol, and that I was apprehensive when the fire reached it, it might injure the inhabitants. They said it would be immediately removed, and that the Capitol would not be blown up. They talked of burning the Washington Bank, but were informed that it was private property, and that it must destroy a great deal of individual property if it should be burnt. Under these considerations, they spared it. They mentioned that it was a painful service to them, that they were disposed to do all in their power to mitigate the distress of the citizens against whom they had no enmity, that their war was with the government and not with the people. All this relieved our fears concerning the city and ourselves. But a most awful scene was yet to follow.
Just as the British couldn't hold territory, the Americans couldn't defend it. So like the British, the U.S. resorted to burning anything that might be of use to the other side.
Right.
That's the awful scene Mary Hunter set out to describe next, as the Americans decided the fate of the U.S. Navy Yard.
Our important Navy Yard was yet to be destroyed by our own hands, the most suicidal act ever committed. No pen can describe the appalling sound that our ears heard, and the sight that our eyes saw. We could see everything from the upper part of our house as plainly as if we had been in the yard. All the vessels of war on fire, the immense quantity of dry timber, together with the houses and stores in flames, produced an almost meridian brightness. You never saw a drawing room so brilliantly lighted as the whole city was that night. Few thought of going to bed. They spent the night in gazing on the fires and lamenting the disgrace of the city.
What a horror. What a horror. And you could almost imagine, really, the visuals of this and to hear the sound, all that wood. I mean, and just what a terrible thing. What a terrible slap in the face to all the things you mentioned before, too, about like we're actually fighting these guys again now. And to have to do this by our own hand was particularly galling. The ladies may have been left alone. Admiral Cockburn still had that score to settle with newspaperman Joe Gales. He wanted to burn the intelligencer to the ground, but American ladies again pleaded for mercy, fearing the flames would spread to their homes. So Cockburn's men tear the building apart by hand.
Yeah.
As for Gales himself, his house might have suffered a similar fate or been burned out, but the newsman's quick-thinking servant shut the place up and wrote "for rent" on the front door, causing the invading troops to pass it by.
On the morning of the 25th, we were introduced to a number of officers, among whom was Admiral Cockburn, who said he admired the American ladies. They made excellent wives and good mothers, but they were very much prejudiced against him. That his friend Joe Gales had told so many lies about him that he was afraid he should never be a favorite. But he said he had paid him by scattering his types, that he had left a line to desire him to publish it in his next paper. He inquired of me, and all the ladies present, in a very particular manner if they had sustained any injury, if any of the soldiers had come into our houses or taken anything from us. He entreated us if anything of that nature occurred, that we would immediately complain, and they should be punished. I began to think ourselves happy, when a most alarming storm of wind and rain came on, which blew down and unroofed many houses. This storm, we believed, hurried the army off. They were in danger of being separated from their shipping. Yours affectionately, Mary Hunter.
When they set upon Gale's printing presses, Cockburn told his men, quote, "Make sure that all the C's are destroyed so that the rascals can have no further means of abusing my name." What a... There's another C word.
Considering his other option was to burn the place down, I guess they kind of tries. You read some of the sources, and we can read the sources of both sides in this war because they're speaking a form of English too. And you read it, and you see he was kind of fun-loving, and that thing that the servant did, he would have thought that was funny because he was kind of a fun-loving little imp of a guy. And it's like, right. Okay. It seemed like he was pretty mad. And think about it, the nickname, the ruffian.
You imagine the ruffian.
Speaking speaking of Twitter, can you imagine if he had to face 5 minutes sitting on Twitter looking at his name being abused now? I guarantee you ruffian would be the least of what you'd be called.
Yeah, exactly. Easily.
And it's also worth noting as I'm listening to that read there,
yeah,
the Westerners were the ones who were really the war hawks in Congress, where that phrase started in this war. They were bothered by the British. They felt they were inciting the Tecumseh and his confederation of native tribes out there, and they were really mad about it. But where does the war come? The war comes in the east. You know, the British are not going to trek all the way out to the Mississippi and start burning down log cabins. So you have to feel particularly bad for some of these people who, like New Englanders, they really suffered, and they flirted a little bit. There was a little bit of talk at the Hartford Convention about maybe just signing a separate peace. Remember, these are independent states back then in the Union. It's not like it is today or after the Civil War. And some people had said, hey, let's just make our own peace. In fact, maybe let's just join Canada again. Let's just become part of the UK. And you could see that when you see what they're doing to the capital. You might just think, well, I guess that this experiment is over before it begins.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the Canadian mindset is often you hear it's like, okay, you know, maybe America should have had more patience. You know, maybe the crown would have acquiesced in some ways, or there could have been some room for further compromise. Instead, we had to decide to get all free and independent, you know?
Well, that Tony Blair clip, he says his son told him, well, Dad, you, no matter how much you mess up when he was elected prime minister, you can't lose the colonies like the prime minister at the time that he was reading about. And he said, oh, thanks, son. That makes it a pretty low bar there. And of course, you had the madness of King George.
Yeah.
At least now you can do things like shuttle diplomacy. The reason they decided to name it shuttle was you could fly back and forth in the days before it took 8 weeks to get a letter.
That's right.
It would have been hard to talk anybody out of things or try to make an accommodation. That's why you'd send guys like John Quincy Adams over there to negotiate a peace to this.
Back at the White House, Richard Jennings described the chaos. Give a listen.
People were running in every direction. John Freeman, the colored butler, drove off in the coachee with his wife, child, and servant. Also a feather bed lashed on behind the coachee, which was all the furniture saved, except part of the silver and the portrait of Washington. I will here mention that although the British were expected every minute, they did not arrive for some hours. In the meantime, a rabble, taking advantage of the confusion, ran all over the White House and stole lots of silver and whatever they could lay their hands on. About sundown, I walked over to the Georgetown Ferry and found the president and all hands waiting for the boat. It soon returned, and we all crossed over and passed up the road about a mile. They then left us servants to wander about. In a short time, several wagons from Bladensburg, drawn by Barney's artillery horses, passed up the road, having crossed the long bridge before it was set on fire.
The presidential party scattered, abandoning the dinner Mrs. Madison had laid out for 40 people. British soldiers enjoyed the meal instead and swilled down the cider and ale meant for the guests that Jennings had laid out. One soldier changed into a clean set of clothes, Mr. Madison's clothes.
Lovely.
Hey, what do you think of this shirt? Does it look presidential? Huh? Can you imagine? It's some guy wearing your clothes. Such an invasion of privacy. That's such a little personal thing there. But if you think that's personal, another soldier picked up a pillow off Dolly's seat. You know, she was a small woman, right? So she had a little pillow to hold her up there. He picked up the pillow, sniffed it, and made a lewd remark that thankfully is lost to history.
Yes. We could probably make up a few.
Yeah, creepy, creepy British guy there. See, they're not all
oh,
Hugh Grant
man.
Ladies.
Exactly. Or maybe they are kind of like, no, all right. Okay. Allegedly, there's a... but anyway, God knows what they did to the hamper up in the bathroom. General Ross couldn't believe how easy the invasion had been. Matter of fact, he's years from now, when he's going to be fighting the Hulk on a regular basis, he's going to really be thankful for these halcyon days of the War of 1812. But he must have laughed at those, like Cockburn, who doubted him.
Yeah.
Jennings stayed with Mrs. Madison and didn't take any guff from the militiamen who'd abandoned their posts at Bladensburg. Here's Jennings describing the flight.
As we were cutting up some planks, a white wagoner ordered us away and told his boy Tommy to reach out his gun and he would shoot us. I told him he had better have used it at Bladensburg.
Let's stop right there. Let's just stop it, because the read is exactly as he wrote it, with just gonads of steel. Think about it. This kid is 15. He's hearing cannons. He's seeing people shot. He knows they're burning down houses. It's complete chaos. And also, he's black. He's a slave, right. A civilian of any color, a woman, anybody is not on equal footing with these soldiers there.
No.
And he's talking back to him and he's telling him, oh, sure, you're going to shoot me. But where were you shooting your gun, Mr. Tough Guy?
Right.
Back at Bladensburg, where, you know, Barney and the rest of those fellas, black and white, by the way, he might have been thinking if he'd known it. Yep. Sure, you're going to shoot me because I'm taking some planks here to try and get away. But what the heck?
Crazy.
Okay, let's cue that back to the top and listen to it again in full.
Right.
You have an idea of what he means there.
Exactly.
As we were cutting up some planks, a white wagoner ordered us away and told his boy Tommy to reach out his gun and he would shoot us.
I told him he had better have used it at Bladensburg. Just then we came up with Mr. Madison and his friends, who had been wandering about for some hours consulting what to do. I walked on to a Methodist minister's and in the evening, while he was at prayer, I heard a tremendous explosion. Rushing out, saw that the public buildings, Navy Yard, rope pole, etc., were on fire.
Paul Jennings was a remarkable young man, and he grew into a remarkable adult. And it's thanks to his memoirs that we have this record of the war. And remember, it's in an era where slaves weren't taught to read and write.
Yeah.
In 2009, dozens of his descendants returned to the White House for a reunion. Imagine what a day that must have been.
Gosh.
You can read more about his journey to freedom in Elizabeth Dowling Taylor's 2012 book, A Slave in the White House, Paul Jennings and the Madisons.
Back in 1814, however, Jennings' prospects for a future and descendants were about as dim as Madison's. Nor could he say, as Igor did in Young Frankenstein, it could be worse. It could be raining. Because sure enough, that storm Mary Hunter described was huge. The winds tore the roofs off houses, but it also helped douse the flames.
The conflagration was visible 50 miles away. Imagine James Madison looking back at that, knowing how he'd failed, knowing his own people were almost as against him and looking to get their hands around his little tiny chicken neck as the British were. He just must have felt so low. Talk about a low moment in the presidency. We've seen quite a few in the 200 years since. He found his way to a tavern, exhausted, hungry, disgraced, wet from the rain, I'm sure. If any president ever needed a belt, it was James Madison that night. But he wasn't a drinker. In fact, Jennings said he didn't think Madison had drank a quart of brandy total in his entire life.
As opposed to, like, you know, the course of an evening, which none of us have ever done, right?
No. Brandy, no.
No. There was no brandy, no. And there was no rest at the tavern, for that matter, either. The party received word that the British were on their way to capture Madison, so he evacuated to, quote, a hovel in the woods. The next day, he crossed the rain-swollen Potomac and found a Quaker settlement. The biggest house said they had no more room for refugees, but the second did.
Only then did Madison's entourage reveal the identity of their guest. Hum, hail to the chief or something, the president. Imagine the astonishment of the people in the house. And imagine the people in the first house saying, oh, gosh, we didn't. Maybe they were glad they turned him away.
Because, sorry. Yeah.
Sandy Heiler, who owns that house today in Brooksville, Maryland, preserves it down to the last detail in period style. She describes Madison as keeping his spirits up, but every now and then he'd get quiet and kind of ponder the disaster.
And at one point, the president asked, do you think they burned my library? To which someone replied, Your Excellency, they burned your whole palace. To a learned man like Madison, that had to be a devastating loss, especially since the war ended up just sort of, you know, fizzling out like those rain-soaked fires.
Once Napoleon was deposed and out of power back in Europe, Britain allied with France and ended the impressment of American seamen and the trade restrictions that had rankled the U.S. In short, there was really no reason to go on fighting, so everybody kind of went home, except for James Madison, whose previous place of residence had undergone some renovations. Instead, he gathered up his smoky belongings, and he lived out the remainder of his presidency in Washington's Octagon House.
It's not nearly as cool. And it was actually there that Madison signed the Treaty of Ghent, ending what detractors mocked as Mr. Madison's War, and later historians dubbed, as we said earlier, the Second War of Independence. But still, there was this question, what to do with that burned-out shell of the White House? In the years leading up to 1812, Congress had periodically suggested moving the seat of government. This seemed like an ideal time to kind of get that done.
But the flames had changed something in the city other than the decor in the White House. The city that Mary Hunter, Paul Jennings, and the Madisons called home was at last the capital of the nation, and the nation embraced it in a way they never had before. There wouldn't be another push to move it until a few years after the Civil War, and that obviously didn't happen. And only when the White House fell into severe disrepair and engineers said, you have to get out of it, Mr. President,
right.
President at the time being Harry Truman, did anyone suggest bulldozing it and building something new.
Today, the White House may still bear the marks of the British invasions, but two centuries and two world wars where we fought side by side have softened any animosity about the vandalism, except, of course, on Twitter.
Yes, Twitter. Follow us at Angry History for at least the intelligent stuff we try to pass on in old pictures. Not a lot of... Yes. We save our angry for the show. That's called compartmentalizing.
So. That's right. That's right. Which is why I've got a stomach ache all the time. No, I'm kidding.
We hope you enjoyed this trip back to 1814, and we plan to deal with this complex forgotten war in future shows, mm-hmm. including the role played by the First Nations that we mentioned as the UK, US, and Dominion of Canada faced off in North America.
We're going to leave you now with the 1812 Overture, which you can actually hear playing under. It didn't have anything to do with our War of 1812. It was actually a song to commemorate Russia's defense of its motherland against Napoleon's invading Grand Army. One of my favorite pieces of music of all time, really sort of a piece that turned something on in my head about history, you know, to be able to sort of get a sense of a story being told through a piece of music. And of course, you know, you can't go wrong with cannons and bells, and it's just a fantastic piece of music.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a bunch of American songs about the invasions, but this is our show, and we figured we can make it a little international, another front on the war, if you want to put it that way. And this was a masterpiece, and it's in honor of repelling people invading your country. And that fits very well with the War of 1812 and the burning in 1814. This is a similar idea, trying to keep the bully in the neighborhood or somebody from pushing you around. And so we hope you enjoyed it. It's performed, by the way, by the Cleveland Orchestra, and that was in 1941. So this performance is a piece of history in and of itself.
Absolutely. Again, we want to give a huge thanks to Don Winston and Amanda Reed for providing us with the great VO work today. They did a great job as usual. And we're recording this on February 21st, which is just a couple days off from the anniversary of the so-called Battle of Los Angeles, which we've been talking a lot about. And today is their big event out at Fort MacArthur here in Los Angeles. I'm psyched for that. It's going to be a reenactment. Just try to get a sense of what happened in Los Angeles that night so long ago when the city lost its collective mind for a little while in the face of something floating in the air. I'm pretty stoked for this. We're going to have a lot of good audio and have that show for you next time, I think.
Yeah, well, good. We'll look forward to it, I'm sure. I will as much as the listeners. I wish that I could be out there, but I'll be here on the East Coast prepared for the British should they try to arrive.
Exactly, and preparing to not lose your toes if you step outside the door. It's still freezing.
Hell, right? Below freezing. Freezing would be so much warmer. Yesterday it was 1 degree. One.
I woke up. I'm just so the listeners know. So obviously I'm 3 hours earlier than Dean and our pals on the East Coast. So, you know, I have sort of opened up a bleary eye occasionally, and I'll see a mail that came in at, you know, whatever, you know, maybe 4 o'clock my time in the morning, 7 o'clock for Dean. And all it is a screen grab of the weather app, and it just says 1 on it. It was awful. Gosh, man. And obviously that's not a problem out here, but, you know, the earth may actually open up here too today. So yeah, that could be a problem. But yeah, man, oh man, 1 degree. You guys are really getting hammered.
Yeah, it's pretty chilly. I'm not very happy with it. But then, of course, knowing history, knowing stories like the Donner Party, or knowing what the Battle of Monmouth here in New Jersey, how bad that winter was. And so it makes you feel a little less like, you know.
Yeah, the Battle for Hoth.
Sure. Ah, the triple. It's part of our comedy heritage, as TV Land used to say. It's an excellent note to leave it on.
It is. And, you know, if we keep talking, actually, we may get through the entire 1812 Overture, which would be fun.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and my tauntaun is double parked, so let's wrap this up.
Guys, this was a fun one. This has been one Dean had been working on for a while, too. And thanks so much, as always, for listening in. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And we'll see you next time on The Angry History Show. Take care.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.
could be worse.
How?
Could be raining.